Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the President's speech today at Knox College, the site of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, where Obama declared that the one thing I care about is how to use every minute of the remaining 1,276 days of my term to make this country work for working Americans again. We will discuss the President's speech with economist and political scientist Thomas Ferguson and also examine the House GOP's budget plans to gut the IRS, the SEC, the EPA, the NEA and the NEH, the CPB and the Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as their threat to use the upcoming debt ceiling increase to force these cuts and defund Obamacare. Then, with the courthouse door closing today on lawsuits to protect the pensions of Detroit's municipal workers, we will speak with the veteran business reporter with the Detroit Free Press, John Gallagher, about the pain and the gain in the city's bankruptcy. He's the author of Reimagining Detroit, Opportunities for Redefining an American City, and we'll also assess the future of a city that has lost over half of its population in the last six decades. Then finally, we'll examine the psychological underpinning of politicians whose risky behavior exposes them to scandal and their wives to humiliation. Dr. John Krosnick, the director of Stanford University's Political Psychology Program, joins us along with Pepper Schwartz, a professor of sociology and sexology at the University of Washington. We'll discuss the latest scandals surrounding Anthony Weiner and Bob Filner. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He's also the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Well, hi there.
And the president made a speech today at Knox College, the site of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, where Obama declared that the one thing I care about is how to use every minute of the remaining 1,276 days of my term to make this country work for working Americans again. What's your response to that call to arms?
It's a bit late, actually, for him to get around to that now, frankly. I think this speech, which I looked at, is pretty much all wind-up and not much pitch. And you can see the problem the president's got. He's looking at a gigantic Republican offensive. It's clear that they're talking again seriously about trying to shut the whole government down. Basically, if Obama doesn't do exactly what they want, in particular repeal the health care bill, but also do big spending cuts. Now, these guys lost the election for president. This is not evidently going to deter them from trying to sort of put their stuff across. I have some sympathy for the White House predicament here. I mean, it's midsummer. People are, you know, on the East Coast, it feels more like Morocco than it does the East Coast. And everybody's sort of bored and unhappy. And he's got to try to get attention. But, you know, I don't think this was particularly effective. The president's popularity has been dropping a touch, not a lot. And I suspect that, I mean, if you look at the fall, it's mostly among African Americans, which I think is pretty clearly related to that Trayvon Martin verdict. And, you know, he was much criticized within the African American community for taking so long to say anything about it. My guess is that, you know, he's not doing particularly well, and the economy's not doing particularly well. And so he's going into a colossal fight, which, admittedly, if he loses it or blows it again, he's blown it several times. You know, I regard the president's negotiations with the Republicans in 2009, in 2010, and also right after the election, you know, in 2010, 2011, when he did effectively adopted a good chunk of the Republican tax program at that point. He didn't do particularly well in these, his only new weapon at this point is probably to try to mobilize public opinion. I suspect he can do it, because the truth is whatever the population thinks of Obama, they almost certainly like the Republicans less. When you look at the polls, they're breaking down very sharply on partisan lines, but there's a large chunk of the population that isn't particularly partisan, and they are mostly, they're thinking much closer to Democrats than they are to Republicans in terms of who's to blame for this. So, you know, all I can say on this one is it's midsummer. It's a long way before we finally get to the debt ceiling discussion. And, you know, this is one the president better do better on than he has in the past. He's not done well in these confrontations.
Well, surely, Thomas Ferguson, though, if the public, and assuming they're paying attention, if they examine the House GOP's budget plans that plan to gut the IRS, the SEC, the EPA, the NEA, the NEH, yep. the CPB, and Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as their threat to use the upcoming debt ceiling increase to force these cuts on the administration and also to defund Obamacare. So this is, I think, one of the most sustained and overwhelming attacks on the government that I have ever – I can't
That's right.
remember anything like this. Have you seen anything like this?
Well, truthfully, I think I saw something like this in 2010, 11, and 12, but I'll let that one pass.
Well, what about cutting the IRS by about 30%, the SEC by 25%, the EPA by 40%?
You look at the Ryan budget, they're pretty sharp cuts over time in just about everything. The real issue here.
By the way, but Tom, just to follow up on that, these are the deficit hawks, for God's sake. And
right.
you cut the IRS by 30%. How the hell are you going to collect revenues? The SEC,
look,
all the fraud that's going to take place,
are
the
we
EPA,
on
the pollution. I mean, God.
Yeah, Ian, look, the deficit noise has never been about really cutting the deficit. It's been about cutting taxes. I'm sorry, if that's not plain, we have a problem. And, you know, the Republican talk about deficits has just been to get tax rates down, and only in the upper brackets. I mean, that, you know, that's why, I mean, you're exactly right. In logic, they shouldn't be cutting the IRS. But for what they're really interested in, cutting the IRS would do a good job, too. I think it's impossible to underestimate the cynicism. To overestimate the cynicism here that the Republicans are bringing to this debate. You know, my take is probably the president wins it, but my bet is it's not going to do much to talk in the midsummer. I actually think they might be losing their touch here a little bit. What they really need to do is sort of sharply focus on those Republican programs. You know, as I read that speech, that's really not quite what they did. And I also think that they may be making a mistake. This is one it's easy to understand why they are making it, which is, you know, they want to treat their re-election, the president's re-election, as a mandate. What I actually think happened in the election is, in the end, the population decided they detested Mitt Romney and the Republicans more than the president. It's not as though folks are on fire with enthusiasm for, you know, let's face it. I mean, this guy's been in office a long time. It's a little late to discover that you have a problem with the shrinking middle class, frankly, and highlight that. I mean, that's the problem here, is the Democratic alternative is so weak and so unattractive. In its own terms, it looks good only by comparison with the Republicans.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Of course, I can't think back when the Democrats' main platform, campaign platform, has always been that we may not be that exciting, but the other guys are really crazy and dangerous. I mean, has it ever been different? I mean, it's true that the other side are more crazy and dangerous than they've ever been, at least in my memory.
Yeah, well, I have to say, for better or worse, I am old enough to remember the Kennedy-Johnson era. You know, Lyndon Johnson, for example, on domestic policy was not simply just better than a bunch of terrible Republicans. And, you know, the truth is that this is something that's gripped the Democratic Party really since the mid-70s. And, you know, they've become another business party. And, you know, what else is there to say here? I mean, the truth is that if the president wants to sort of beat these guys back, he needs to change course a bit. And it would help if he would just admit he needs to change course. And I just think you cannot go to the population and say, guess what? You know, we really need to do something about the middle class. You know, what were they thinking in 2009, 2010, 2011, particularly when, you know, with the weak economic recovery programs? And look, these guys have to make a major decision on the economy very soon. Right now, you see all these articles, who will be the next chair of the Fed? You know, there's serious discussion that it could possibly be Larry Summers. You know, the only thing you can say on that is if the president appoints Summers, well, at that point, I think the whole population should turn its back on him. I mean, Summers, you know, destroyed the world in the 90s with that crazy pitch. Even he went to the state of California to promote, you know, the famous utility deregulation, not to mention the deregulation of finance. And his performance in the president's office in 2009 and 10 was also completely lackluster. You know, the memos are public, at least some of them. We know he was among those urging the small fiscal stimulus, I mean, big only by comparison with, you know, some folks who wanted even smaller. I mean, the notion that you could be seriously contemplating this guy as appointing the Fed, and this is happening. I mean, it's plain from reading, if you read the Washington Press, it's clear that inside the White House, there's a serious constituency that's trying to persuade the president to appoint Summers. You know, well, if he appoints Summers, you know, all I can say is just laugh when they start talking about the middle class preservation. It's just ridiculous.
Well, Tom Ferguson, you read the speech. I saw it, and the most emotional point where the president's voice rose was when he declared, "The one thing I care about is how to use every minute of the remaining 1,276 days of my term to make this country work for working Americans again." Now, obviously, there is a gulf between rhetoric and reality, and as you've pointed out, it's the summer, and the Republicans are coming out with all guns blazing to eviscerate the federal government and to rip everything to shreds that he's ever done and ever attempted to do. And he's got to rally some people behind him. And, you know, you've got a polity in this country where on the right, they hate this guy and disrespect him in a way that's unprecedented and obscene. And on the left, you've got a tremendous amount of disillusion. So I don't know where he's going to get the impetus from, frankly.
I think in the end, it will come, as usual, from the Republicans. That is to say, they're going to overplay their hand. You know, what they're talking about really is crazy. It is worse than anything the president is proposing, by far. And so, you know, one trusts that in the end, enough common sense will show up, you know, even in Washington, that this thing will get out of it. But this is really a pretty low level. It's the sort of thing that makes you despair of democratic institutions, frankly. I mean, and let's face it, the problem here is, you know, I'm sorry to use my usual pitch, but since the usual pitch is exactly right, this is big money dominating the Republican Party and big money dominating the Democratic Party, leaving the rest of us kind of on the sidelines.
So a letter has been drafted by Senators Mike Lee of Utah, Ted Cruz of Texas, and Rand Paul of Kentucky, stating that if the Democrats will not agree with Republicans and that Obamacare must be repealed, perhaps they can at least agree with the president that the law cannot be implemented as written. If the administration will not enforce the law as written, then the American people should not be forced to fund it. Now, What is this obsession with repealing Obamacare, and do they have the means to, maybe through the debt ceiling or something else?
Well, they can threaten and they can try to, you know, in some sense, put the whole economy hostage. I think in the end it wouldn't work, and I think in the end the Republicans will fissure as they have before, if you're asking me for sort of a clinical appraisal. I think the obsession here is, I mean, look, you know, I and my colleagues, Ji Chen and Paul Jorgensen, we're completing a big review of political financing in 2012. And the amount of cash going in from to Republicans from health care companies of all types, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, you name it, it's gigantic. It's just overwhelming. And, you know, these folks have tremendous sums of money. They have ripped the pop, they have ripped us all off for literally for decades. And the Obamacare thing is way short of perfection, but it does contain some constraints on them. You know, it's already slowing the growth of health care spending. I mean, it's not the only factor doing that, but for sure it's probably part of it. And, you know, look, this is a case where a gigantic, powerful financial interest is trying to stalemate in Washington some regulation. You know, we've seen this before. We've seen it with the banks. You know, we're still seeing it. I mean, basically, what you got here in Washington is one giant interest group after another. Finance, telecom is incidentally another. The banks, healthcare. These people just mulked the population, and they don't like it if they're going to be blocked from that. You know, this is part of the stakes of this big fight. You look at where the deals were made, you know, to confirm those nominees. When the Republicans would not confirm the president's nominees to the EPA, in the environment, in the National Labor Relations Board, the Consumer Protection Agency that's supposed to oversee the finance. I mean, this tells you exactly where we're at here.
So what's your sense then of what's happened to outrage then? Are people just beaten down with their day-to-day struggles?
And if you look at polls, people hate the Washington. They hate the Congress. Right. They'd say they vote. I mean, some huge chunk of them now want to just vote everybody out. There's no way to do that on a single ticket. They don't really like Obama, and they detest the Republicans. They detest them, is my reading of it, a little more. The problem here is this doesn't get into the media. You know, the media mostly just sits there and repeats, frankly, hugely subsidized talking heads over and over. I mean, the news commentary in the United States is pretty worthless. The ordinary person's concerns just don't make it into there. I think you'd have no trouble finding people's distaste for this political system is very high. I am sure that, you know, in the midsummer, with high unemployment, it's tough to get anything organized. Folks will be, there'll be more happening. You know, the Occupy movement, the Tea Party, right? The Tea Party's clearly been captured by big business. I think that's absolutely clear. The Occupy movement, you know, was partly contained, partly by huge blanket police work. I mean, there were lots of demonstrations planned for the national political conventions. The response was, frankly, ferocious. But, you know, I doubt you're going to, this is not the end of the discussion in the United States. Let's just wait a little bit. I mean, you can feel the disgust of the population mounting. What you're not seeing in the media is the way it fixes on both political parties. I think for very good justified reasons. You're not looking at a big swing to the right. That's not my reading of polls where even on immigration and gay rights, you've got, you know, now reasonable majorities favoring some action against the existing state, against the status quo. There's a lot of anger out there in the United States. It's going to surface. But my guess is in this short-run debate, we're going to have to wait for the Republicans to threaten to ruin the entire country and the economy. And then I think you'll see a revulsion. You will see it both against the president and the Republicans, but you will see it more against the Republicans.
Well, just in closing, Thomas Ferguson, it would seem to me that it's long overdue for a national debate on the extent to which we are still a democracy and have not become ruled totally by an oligarchy. You mentioned your groundbreaking book, Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Of course, the floodgates have been opened by this Supreme Court that also just threw out the Voting Rights Act, or the main part of it, and now we've seen exactly what happened after that. Now they're suppressing the vote in all these southern states.
You get a rash of voter suppression.
Well, you sit and you get a flood of money. So it's even the courts are corrupt, and they're clearly totally on the side of the oligarchs and the Republicans. And my sense is that. You know, we're going to have a discussion about the real reality, which is, do we still have a democracy and do we still have an economy and not a plutonomy?
Look, I think the vote is very soon in the House on that amendment on the NSA. I mean, that's a warning for everybody. This is sort of shows you just how crazy party competition is in America. I mean, this was the Obama administration that was promoting, all of the latest revelations, PRISM and all those programs. That should give you pause. I mean, it's clear to me that, the notion that sort of the national security state was the vast extension of that under Bush and Cheney, the usual view, I think, was that was something that was kind of a pathology from the Republicans. That's plainly too simple a view here. No, we have a problem. And virtually everybody's metadata is being swallowed into government computer, not government, but private companies, which is the other very interesting thing on this. Private companies' computers, which then just move seamlessly to the government, that's a problem. That's a very large problem.
Well, Thomas Ferguson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah, have a happy night.
Thank you.
Okay,
bye. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He's a member of the advisory board for George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor for The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the business editor of the Detroit Free Press. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Gallagher, a veteran business reporter with the Detroit Free Press, who for more than two decades has covered architecture, urban and economic development, and other subjects. His books include Great Architecture of Michigan, AIA Detroit, The American Institute of Architects' Guide to Detroit Architecture, and his latest book is Reimagining Detroit, Opportunities for Redefining an American City. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Gallagher.
Thank you very much.
And you wrote recently, John, that local business leaders portrayed Detroit's bankruptcy up bankruptcy as a painful but necessary and ultimately positive step towards positioning the city for new growth. So today, I understand the courthouse door closed on those that are suing to protect their pensions, the municipal workers. So do you have a divided city? The business community happy and the working community are not?
That's one way to put it. The retiree, the city municipal unions representing about 8,000 or 9,000 city workers and about 19,000 city retirees are just beside themselves over the cuts that are coming to both to the workforce and probably to pensions and health care, although we're not quite sure how that's going to work out yet. And the business community thinks that, you know, Detroit's been Detroit city government has been so dysfunctional for so long that this is probably, you know, a necessary painful cleansing process to go through this bankruptcy. But Wall Street is also very upset because all these firms like Goldman Sachs that bought City of Detroit bonds backed by the full faith and credit of the City of Detroit are now being told they're going to get pennies on the dollar, you know, maybe 10 cents on the dollar. So Wall Street firms are all upset too. So it's not like this is like you're picking on, just the municipal unions in this. This is pain across the board for everybody who does business with the City of Detroit.
Well, Governor Rick Snyder on the Sunday Washington talk show said that the people in Detroit weren't getting their services. So what is the story behind that? Is there because when police and firemen are threatened to lose their pensions and they don't get Social Security, that's pretty radical. And tell me what goes on there. Surely the firemen and the police show up when they have to. So what's the complaint against city workers?
It's not so much against city workers. It's just that the city has been so underfunded for so long because of all the things we know about suburban sprawl and deindustrialization and the fact that the federal government subsidized, people leaving the city and building homes in the suburbs for many, many years, for decades. That is broke and so dysfunctional that our services are probably the worst of any big city in the country. Let me explain. At any given night, an estimated like 40% of the streetlights are out in the city of Detroit, 40%. The 911 response times are probably, worse, much worse than the average. Instead of having a cop car there in 5 minutes, you might get one in 45 minutes. People have told me they call 911 and the operator doesn't even answer sometimes. So there's a lot of, a real lack of services. And in what Governor Snyder and his emergency manager in the city have said is that, it's going to be very painful for city workers and for the retirees and for the Wall Street bondholders, but they're really thinking of the 700,000 of us, including me, who live in the city of Detroit, that, you know, we deserve better services. And by kind of stiffing the Wall Street people and by inflicting pain on the city workers and the unions and the retirees, you'll free up money to actually make this a workable, you know, livable city again for everybody else. That's the argument. So.
But why punish people who have worked hard, presumably, and if it's not their fault, and that they paid into their pensions, they expect it? I mean, that's a social contract, isn't it, a pension?
Oh, right. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, the big tragedy here is what may happen to city retirees. I mean, I've talked to many city retirees who too tell me, you know, I'm on medication, I'm not going to be able to afford my medication. I live on my pension. I get, whatever it is, $25,000-$30,000 a year. That's what I live on. And you're telling me you're going to cut that. There is going to be a huge amount of human pain inflicted on this, unless they come up with some way to spare, the current retirees and only with the younger workers, sort of cut off the pensions for those still working in some fashion. Much as, in Congress, you hear talk about reforming Social Security only for those who are, say, 45 and younger. So there could be some way out of this, but the problem is there doesn't appear to be a lot of money in the till. The city's tax rates are already the highest allowed in the state. They've been borrowing, they've been running huge, $100 million, $200, $300 million deficits every year. They've been borrowing very heavily year after year after year with no hope of paying it back. And so the city finances are just shambles, and they've got to do something to try and straighten them out. So one of the advisors to the city and all this has betrayed this as sort of a Bernie Madoff scheme where Wall Street's been buying into a totally insolvent city for the last 10 to 15 years, and they should have known better. So, yeah, I mean, there is a social contract, and it's probably going to be broken unless they can figure out some way around it and make the Wall Street people pay even more than they're going to pay.
Again, I'm speaking with John Gallagher, a veteran business reporter with the Detroit Free Press, who for more than two decades has covered architecture, urban and economic development, and other subjects. His books include Great Architecture of Michigan, AIA Detroit, the American Institute of Architects' Guide to Detroit Architecture, and his latest book is Reimagining Detroit, Opportunities for Redefining an American City. Now, this has obviously been long in coming. You've had, in the last six decades, the population of Detroit's gone from 1.8 million to 700,000. You had, over the decades, the big auto companies and the big unions seem to sort of, in many ways, get sort of fat, dumb, and happy together. Meanwhile, eventually, I don't know what the percentage of cars that are manufactured in the South and in these right-to-work states, but I think that's clearly where there's been a massive migration, massive downsizing, robotics have come in, et cetera. So the main business is affected enormously. So give us a sense of what the big drivers of this slow-motion catastrophe are.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was probably, if you were a blue-collar worker, there was no better place to be in the 1950s than in Detroit. I mean, wages were something like 130% of the national average. There were, you know, there were whole generations of families that worked for Fords or GM or Chrysler. You could be a family of five or six kids with a working husband in the auto factory, and the mom would stay at home and raise five or six kids, and you could send the kids to Catholic school, and you could have a second home up north. I mean, it was just the best possible lifestyle for working people, and it was based on these huge monopoly market share that existed for the auto companies and the steel companies and American industry in general in the post-war years. And as other countries recovered from World War II, the Japanese and the European auto companies came along, the steel companies, and began to eat into the Americans' market share. People began to suburbanize, and that was fine with the federal government. They subsidized that. And all of that drained jobs and tax base out of the city, so that now, if you look at the tax base in regional Southeast Michigan, suburban Detroit, the city of Detroit occupies just 6 or 7% of the tax base. 93, 94% of the tax base is now in the suburbs of Detroit. So the city has been hollowed out. And as you said, we went from almost 2 million people down to 700,000, you know, a two-thirds percentage decline. A lot of other cities are suffering the same thing, but not quite as far along as Detroit is. I mean, percentage declines of 40% population are pretty common in old line industrial cities. So Detroit is kind of at the leading edge of sort of the broken model of what were great industrialized centers, metropolitan centers in the mid-20th century. And all of these, I mean, the Buffaloes, St. Louis's, Cleveland's, Pittsburgh's, have all declined. Some have done better than others in recovering. Why Detroit did not do better, that's a long story. But, you know, it calls to mind Hemingway's famous quote about you go broke two ways, slowly and then quickly. The slowly was the 50-year decline in suburban sprawl and loss of factory jobs. And the quickly part was the, you know, sort of the bad decisions made over the last 10 years where they were just borrowing just to keep their heads above water.
So, John Gallagher, what are some of the proposals here in terms of you mentioned that that Wall Street may take a haircut, but the idea that that the courthouse door is now closed on attempts for the pensioners to sue, and of course the according to the Constitution of Michigan, these pensions should be protected, but now it's in the hands of a federal judge, and the courthouse door is closed. There's even some talk of selling the art collection, which is apparently substantial. Now, that doesn't make sense, does it, to sell that to a bunch of, oligarchs, the one percenters, who will put these paintings in a mansion somewhere in East Hampton and nobody ever see them. Why not sell them to the federal government? I mean, what kind of creative ways are there to raise money, or is it just are the same people in charge that made all these reckless, desperate borrowings?
Well, the business about the art collection, through a kind of a quirky situation. The city of Detroit owns the art collection for the Detroit Institute of Arts. In most cities, that's not the case, I think. But Detroit does hold title to the artwork. And so it's been suggested that the city sell off its Picassos and whatever in what is usually thought to be a top five collection in the United States and raise some money that way. The problem with that, of course, is that you kind of destroy the cultural heart of the city. And the governor has said he doesn't want to do that. And, in fact, his attorney general has given an opinion that says they can't do that. But all of this is going to be litigated. The Michigan Constitution protects municipal pensions for city workers. Some people believe that federal law in a federal bankruptcy case would trump that. But that's never been litigated. So that will be litigated in this case, and we'll find out which is stronger, the Michigan Constitution or the federal bankruptcy code. And that will set a precedent for decades to come. The whole business about selling the art collection, that will probably wind up in court, too. I mean, everyone expects that this is not going to be what some call a quick rinse bankruptcy like General Motors went through a few years ago where they're in and out in 30 days. This is more like 3 years. And every single question is going to be litigated right down the line. Can the pensioners sue? Well, as of today, they can't. As you noted, the bankruptcy judge in federal court said, no, I'm going to take all this stuff. Other suits are on hold until I decide what to do. But will that hold up when it goes to the Supreme Court? Well, we'll see. So, there's all kinds of schemes and dreams and suits and lawsuits and challenges out there. And, we're just going to have to live through this for the next couple of years.
Well, I thank you for joining us, John Gallagher. And, let's stay in touch. I hope there's some good news here somewhere. I'm searching for it, and I'm sure you're looking for it,
well,
too.
Well, if I could just take 20 seconds. I mean, sure. There is a lot of good stuff happening in the city. I mean, the economy is actually, the regional economy is doing pretty well, and our downtown and midtown areas are thriving. And so it's actually, the failure of the city government sometimes reflects badly on the whole thing, the culture and the heart of the city and the economy, when it's actually a discrete piece that we're working through here. So, life needs to be a lot better than it is in Detroit. But, we're hanging in there. We're moving ahead.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us, John Gallagher.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with John Gallagher, who's a veteran business reporter with the Detroit Free Press, who for more than two decades has covered architecture, urban and economic development. And his books include Great Architecture of Michigan, AIA Detroit, the American Institute of Architects Guide to Detroit Architecture. And his latest book is Reimagining Detroit, Opportunities for Redefining an American City. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with some political psychologists about the latest political scandals.
Save the money, just say what it used to be. Man, now we used to tear apart this town. Put a dollar into the machine and you'll remember how.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. John Krosnick, the director of Stanford University's Political Psychology Program. He's also the Frederick O. Glover Professor in Humanities and Social Sciences at Stanford. Dr. Krosnick received the Eric Erickson Award for Excellence in Creativity in the Field of Political Psychology from the International Society of Political Psychology. And also joining us is Pepper Schwartz, a professor of sociology and sexology at the University of Washington in Seattle. She has been profiled by The New York Times, People, Seattle Magazine, Metropolitan Magazine, Time, Newsweek, and Law and Politics Magazine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Krosnick and Pepper Schwartz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Krosigk, let me begin with you. I guess the question of the moment here is, given Anthony Weiner's problems and also the mayor of San Diego, Bob Filner's problems, that I'm trying to understand the psychological underpinning of politicians whose risky behavior exposes them to scandal and their wives to humiliation. I can just, you know, if you need them to be reminded, I can throw a few names out there as well as Anthony Weiner. You've got Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich, David Vinter, and Mark Stanford, all of them who, of course, were redeemed. I'm not sure that Weiner will be. So what is it about these politicians?
Well, it's you know, certainly the situation that politicians find themselves in is one where they often exist in a bubble. One of my favorite stories comes from the George W. Bush presidency, when at one point Mrs. Bush was asked about how the president felt about his low approval rating in the country toward the end of his presidency. And Mrs. Bush said, you know, I don't see how these polls can be right, because everybody we talk to loves the job that he's doing. And I think that's an indication of the kind of bubble that politicians understandably get into that may give them a sense of invulnerability. And you mentioned Bill Clinton. I think the Clinton experience is a particularly important one because, as I think many people remember, even though when the Monica Lewinsky scandal was revealed, ratings of Clinton as a person declined in the country, but his approval rating as president did not decline one drop. And so there was a sense in which Americans said, you know, I may not want to have a beer with the guy anymore, but he's doing a good job as president. The country, the economy is doing well. We're doing it well internationally. And so people can see the difference between those. And you can imagine that that also might give politicians a sense of invulnerability if they feel they're professionally competent.
And Pepper Schwartz, the list of names that I just read, all of whom have had had their road to Damascus experience and come back, I'm not sure that Weiner will. I must say that what I was struck by most of all was the humiliation that the poor wife was going through, and I remember that also from Vitter's wife, and I remember that also from the New Jersey, I think he was a governor who turned out to be gay, and his wife really was deeply embarrassed. So tell me about the wives of these men. Why do they stand by them?
Well, a lot of them have this "I'm with a great man" syndrome, and I have to suffer for that. And I want to protect my relationship, even though he done me wrong. And even though I am a woman of my own stature, as in Hillary or Yuma, Huma, I guess it's pronounced, that's nothing compared to him. So they sort of buy into his narcissism, which is, you know, I should be allowed to do what I do. Yes, these are picadillos. Yes, they have humiliated you, but I deserve to be president, or I deserve to be mayor, and they buy into that. And that's complicated, of course, by their what they think of marriage and having children, and what that would do to, you know, their values about that. But I think this sort of reflected glory and willing to suffer for your man kind of thing is still very female. And while they struggle to keep their dignity in terms of what they say and how they stand there, you can see it's excruciating. And what is interesting is that their husbands are willing to put them through it, and they are willing to go along.
And Dr. John Krosigk, is this something unique about the Anglo-Saxons? Because I used to work for the BBC, and I can remember some really bizarre scandals involving sex with all kinds of sexes and with politicians at the highest council in government. And if you contrast the names and the list that I just read a little while ago and the current situation with Weiner and Filner in San Diego, compare that, for example, to the French, you know, the famously Mitterrand's funeral his wife attended along with the mistress, and also their illegitimate daughter showed up as well. So is this uniquely Anglo-Saxon, to this tortured relationship between sex and politics?
Well, you can certainly, French is an example that comes immediately to mind, of course, as you say, where, you know, there are a different set of standards. And, you know, that's a case where, you know, you might imagine that individuals who have been essentially feeling to be family members of his over time would feel entitled to come to his funeral. That's, you know, obviously a different question from whether the society forgives this kind of behavior in its leaders. And the truth is we have seen evidence in a number of other countries where citizens say, okay, what's the problem? This is his or her private life. This is not something that we need to be passing judgment on if he or she is doing a good job for the country. And so it raises a very interesting question about America, that we have a set of collective values that suggest that this behavior is abhorrent. And so when the press latch on to something like this, make an issue of it, it's everybody sort of knows the script, which is this is a behavior to be condemned. But the important question, I think, at that point is, are Americans eventually going to come around to say, well, you know, maybe it's better to have somebody competent running the country, regardless of what I think about their private life. In other words, asking, I will decide whether to vote for this person for president or not based upon whether I'd like to have a beer with him or her, is a pretty interesting strategy, given that the likelihood of any of us having a beer with that person is pretty low.
And Pepper Schwartz, what's your take on this peculiar mixture here in the United States between piety, pornography, and politicians and piety? Obviously we have a lot of value voters on the Christian right, but then, of course, you've had an equal number of scandals of many of their luminaries falling from grace. So how much are we unique in our religiosity in politics?
We are fairly unique. We are an extremely religious country. One might argue that in the top 1% of religious countries. And we do, in fact, have a high level of being hypocrites. I mean, we don't do what we value, but we stick up for our values anyhow. However, I would like to make an exception in the sense, I think, you have Governor Sanford, who, you know, his wife divorced him, he married his true love, and I think people go, okay. But the level of compulsivity, the idea that something's wrong with this guy, is different than just having, you know, a personal relationship with another woman. Moreover, the level of obsessiveness in that after he was humiliated, caught, and had to leave his job and enter treatment and do the whole, you know, tail between your legs public deal, he continued to do the same behavior.
And, of course, you're referring to Anthony Weiner, the person of the moment, right?
Yes. Well, but, I mean, I think the difference is the public looking at a man like Weiner, who's compulsive, who simply cannot control his behavior, versus somebody who has an affair. The affair looks like motherhood and apple pie next to this.
Right. Well, but isn't there, at the risk of sounding like a pop psychologist, isn't it pretty clear that there's a full measure of narcissism here? The pictures he takes of his buffed body and all, not to mention his crotch, but his buffed body, I mean, doesn't that scream out at you?
Oh, yes. I mean, it is narcissistic, and he is narcissistic in just about any way you want to check the boxes. But the fact is, there's a popular saying among Americans these days called TMI, too much information. If you drag us into your life, and indeed, if you drag unsuspecting women out there with anonymous identities and create a loop with them that they're really unaware of who they're dealing with, you take it out of the sort of private zone where we'd love it to stay, and you then make us have to be party to this, which we really don't want to be.
And Dr. John Krasnick, again, the director of the Stanford University Political Psychology Program, do you see any in your research, any thread here in terms of risky behavior and that being a kind of psychological defect of those that enter politics?
Yeah, I think that's a very natural question to ask, that if an individual is taking risky and self-destructive acts in his or her private life, is that an indicator of the danger that that person would put the country in? And psychologists actually have been studying this question for at least 60 years with lots of careful looks and lots of debate. And what we found actually remarkably is it's tempting to think that we can describe each other with very broad personality traits, like he's smart or she's outgoing or he's fearful. And what we've learned is that that's not right, that even with regard to intelligence, there is not one attribute of each of us that describes our intelligence. We have lots of intelligences. We're maybe good at reading maps and not so good at doing math. And similarly, it turns out that behaviors like risk-taking are very situation-specific. A person who might smoke cigarettes and take risks with his or her health is not necessarily at all a risk-taker when driving or when running the country. And so it's very tempting to say, this guy is nuts. He's done self-destructive things repeatedly, addictively. How can we trust him with the country? And I'm afraid that, you know, that the psychological research wouldn't support the idea that that's diagnostic of that person's political behavior.
Yeah, but what the alternative, though, is, I think, in many ways, is also alarming, the idea that the only people that you should have running politics are members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I mean, just completely pious and prudish people who haven't had a lot of life experience and sort of eunuchs. I mean, that seems to me to be almost worse.
Yeah, there is certainly that risk. Now, I will acknowledge that as a person who has a second career as a musician, I kind of like your image of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir being in charge. But the idea that our standards would be such that the conservative morality that is, as you know, we've heard so correctly, it is widely endorsed in the country, becomes a requirement. In fact, I'm not sure it is a requirement in the electoral process. In fact, we don't see that at all in the electoral process. But it does become a lever to unseat politicians when the press get a hold of a scandal and can put the spotlight on and say to Americans, really? You want this person in elected office?
Pepper Schwartz, again, professor of sociology and sexology at the University of Washington in Seattle. Tell me, what's your response to the idea that maybe the choices between piety and this kind of behavior, that maybe that you could have somebody that's too pious, too proper, hasn't had enough life experience? What's your response to that?
Well, I think that's the history of the United States. We've had a lot of people who mouthed to that. Those pieties, and you know, and that's where we get our scandals from. But I think that's a dichotomization that's not necessary. I mean, increasingly, because of the baby boom and all the people who followed it, we're going to have people with paths, and I think people are willing to accept.
Is that your phone, Pepper? Yeah, let's see if we can call Pepper back maybe, because the phone's is quite unpleasant. Dr. John Krosnick, again, the director of Stanford University's Political Psychology Program. We have a situation where you've got a Congress now that is, I think, historically down to about 8% approval. And frankly, I wonder who that 8% are, but it couldn't be worse. And we're talking about a couple of very prominent liberal Democrats who are in trouble, Wiener, who had to leave the Congress, and Bob Filner, who quit to become mayor of San Diego and is now in trouble. And I mentioned all the other ones as well earlier who've had some political redemption. But the long and the short of it is that it seems to me that the question is, you know, why is it that you have this universal contempt for politicians at the same time they have more tenure than academics do? I mean, there's less turnover in the United States Congress than there was in the Supreme Soviet of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
Yes, well, it's certainly true that the American public's approval of Congress is at an all-time low. And it's also true that incumbents who are in the Congress have a remarkably high probability of being reelected. And that's apparently a dilemma on the surface. If we are unhappy with Congress, why don't we throw them out? The challenge is that we can each only vote out one person. And yet what research shows is that people are not unhappy with their representative. They're unhappy with the system, with the collective in Washington, where at this point it's extremely predictable. The Democrats in Congress only vote for bills put up by Democrats, and the Republicans in Congress only vote for bills put up by Republicans. It didn't used to be this way. There used to be cooperation and collaboration decades ago. That's disappeared now, and it's caused this gridlock. In fact, you may know that the leader of one of the political parties in Washington in the Congress has pronounced that he will allow nothing to get passed during the Obama administration. And so I think that's the sentiment that has Americans beside themselves with frustration. But the solution is not vote their own congressional representative out, particularly if they like that person's politics and approach to what's going on. And it would certainly be understandable not to hold that person responsible for the dysfunction of the collective. So the real question is, you know, what's causing it? And many people who are doing research into this are pointing increasingly to the campaign finance situation, that essentially the once incumbents are in office, the fundraising efforts reinforce exactly what's happening, which is sort of among people as well as
No, I just wanted to get a quick word from Pepper Schwartz here, who we lost there for a moment. Just in terms of getting the politics we deserve and the politicians we deserve, Congress has an all-time low approval of 8%, which again seems even high to me. But here we have the paradox: you got universal contempt for the Congress, yet we keep reelecting these people. Go figure.
Well, you know, the problem is each person is elected by a relatively narrow band of people. And they're responsible, particularly in Congress, to that narrow band of people. So they'll get reelected till the cows come home if their constituency is ideologically extreme, so that they're less interested in movement and more interested in representation of that ideology. I mean, sometimes I think we get who we deserve, and that frightens me, of course.
Well, tell me about that just in the last minute then. Why is it that – is it the fact that there are only 90% of our politicians are women, that this is more of a problem with men? Or do you think women, if they get more of them in politics, will have an equal number of scandals?
No, I don't think we'll have equal numbers of scandals. For one thing, the paraphilias, like the thing that Wiener's doing where he needs to expose himself for his sexual thrills. Well, those things are about 97% male. We don't really understand why they're so extremely male. I mean, it's very rare for women to have some of this more bizarre behavior, having an affair, having a lover. There's the younger statistics on younger people seem to indicate that women will be doing more of that now that, you know, they've had this socialization of hooking up and stuff. But I think the things that are at this level of impulsiveness will not be done as much by women, both because they don't have the same kind of sexual kinks, they just don't, and secondly, because they have children and they seem to be more mindful of the consequences to those children than the men do. You know, does that make them better politicians? No, I suppose it makes them less interesting reading. But I think that that having women in office will make it both duller, and maybe we can concentrate a little bit more on what they do or do not.
Well, I welcome the dullness, and I thank both of you for joining us here, Dr. John Krasnick, Director of Stanford University Political Psychology Program, and Pepper Schwartz, a Professor of Sociology and Sexology at the University of Washington in Seattle. Thank you both.
My pleasure.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producers Claire Goldsmith and Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Sing